Okay, my name is Jim Reithmiller, and I'm sitting here with Dr. C. Norman Geis in the breakfast table of his home in Grosse Pointe. It's a Saturday afternoon, approximately 1:45 on October 11, 1980. Dr. Geis, could you tell me a little bit about your background prior to your coming to Wayne State in 1947?
Yes. I came here in 47 at the age of 36. I had gone through school, largely in Arkansas, and had gotten out, and I didn't graduate from high school. I didn't bother to graduate. I went straight on to college, undergraduate school, at the end of the third year. Because I had sufficient credits and I was accepted. I was 16 years old at the time. I went on then through that particular college, studying history and other sorts of subjects, but not majoring in history ultimately, but majoring in economics, although I took a strong minor in history and in French, with a sizable number of hours in English in addition, although literary criticism is not one of my major interests. I was on the college newspaper and the college, what do you call the annual, but didn't bother much with other activities except I sang and did play a little baseball one year. But otherwise was not particularly active in sports or student affairs. I lived at home, since the college was in the town that I lived in, Conway, Arkansas. And my record was not very distinguished in that I had what you could call the preacher's son B instead of the gentleman C. In fact, my undergraduate record was almost solidly B's. But I didn't get them because I was studying hard. I got them because I wasn't studying hard. I did enough work to get by and keep my parents satisfied, but not enough really to have an outstanding record. I think, in fact, I had 7 C's and 7 A's, and all the rest were B's or B pluses. After that, not too dazzling start, when I graduated in 31, it was certainly an awful year financially for my family and for everybody else in the country. But since I lived in the South, the Depression wasn't that new, and that actually the Southern Depression began about 5 or 6 years before that, the agricultural depression particularly. But nevertheless, although my family situation was not good financially, I did go on off to graduate school for a year at Duke University to study history, and decided after I got there, more or less, to study Latin American history, although I'd never had a course in it. There were no such courses taught in the undergraduate school I'd gone to. And my prior main interest had actually been in medieval history, so it seems a little strange, but I went on in and was largely interested in the colonial period, so perhaps that's not too far afield from the medieval period. I had a year there at Duke, and in a sense it was my first experience in a college dormitory situation. I had a lot of fun playing around. I belonged to a fraternity to which my family, most all of the members, had belonged. My uncles, my father, my older brother, and so forth and so on. And I did a little studying, but not too much. And I didn't complete my degree in that year, although that was not because I wasn't studying. It was just more than I could bite. I learned a little Spanish, I took some courses in Latin American history from Alan Manchester and J. Fred Rippey and John Tate Lanning, who all were noted in their fields, although Manchester and Lanning were just coming on as young men then. And the other man, Rippey, was just on the verge of moving from Duke back to Chicago, where he had been before he came to Duke. I had to drop out at the end of that year because of finances, and I didn't get back to work on my degree until the spring of 1936. In the meantime, I worked at odd jobs for a year. I taught in a country school, high school, for a year, and I worked in an office in North Carolina in the last case, and Arkansas in the other cases. I did go back to complete my degree, and did complete it in that spring and summer of 1936. Having, in fact, I was more or less felt pressured to go back because Rippey was there for that period and then was going on to Chicago again. And if I was going to finish my degree with Rippey, I had to get it at that point. I finished it, got a job teaching in high school in Arkansas, and almost immediately was made, well, after one term, I guess, was made the vice principal of the high school, as well as a teacher there. I more or less accepted the notion immediately, at least, the depression was still continuing, of staying on in high school teaching, although it wasn't my real dish of tea, in that there was too little chance to teach a particular subject and too many problems or incipient problems with discipline and that sort of thing. I was forced to be active in both sponsoring student organizations and that sort of thing, and that is not my dish of tea either, but bearable, I suppose. I stayed on there for 2 years and seemed destined to go on into the principalship. Was engaged to a local girl, seemed destined, in other words, to stay. And at that point, I was offered a fellowship to go off again to do graduate work in Latin American history. And this was a private fellowship, not one that was associated with any particular university. I took it, and after exploring the possibilities of where I could go, I decided to go to Berkeley, California, since that was actually where a number of my profs had studied, and I was interested in the place.
Excuse me, Dr. Geist, do you think then that Professors Rippey and Lanning are primarily responsible for your initial interest in Latin America?
Rippey particularly. Lanning ultimately more so than Rippey. Rippey was a marvelous lecturer. Very low key, in the sense that he seemed always to be reading a manuscript. He wasn't, but he just talked in that fashion as if he were. It was a continuous flow. And he was way above average as a lecturer. But frankly, while he glittered in a sense and attracted, I think as one got deeper and deeper into the field, one grew less and less, to have less and less respect for his scholarship. And it was Lanning that I came to appreciate much more than Rippey. Your point is well taken, though, in that I think many people do get him. Certainly it's been proved over and over again in history that people fall into particular fields of history on the basis of an attraction brought by a particular prop. Mm-hmm. You're right in that extent.
Mm-hmm.
But it was the colonial period that I liked particularly, and that was Lanning's period.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came to appreciate John Tate Lanning much more than Rippey, in fact. Although Rippey was incisive and, as I said, spectacular as a lecture. No fireworks, but just very meaty type lecture
mm-hmm.
that you could that could be very attractive. Well, I went to Berkeley then in 1938, and with the hopes of studying with the great dean of Latin American Studies and Border Studies, Herbert E. Bolton. But when I arrived, I found that I couldn't study with him because he was at the point of facing up to an imminent retirement, and he decided that he wasn't taking any new students at that point, so that none of the people who came there in 1938 got to work with him. I had a choice then of working with Priestley, Herbert I. Priestley, whose field was Mexican colonial history, and who was the director of the Bancroft Library, which is the great research library for the field. But Priestley wasn't attractive as a director of studies, and he ultimately had very few people working with him because of that. He just couldn't seem to come to grips with the particular problems. He was more interested in his own writing and not really interested in students. I could have worked with Lawrence Kinnaird, although and would have enjoyed working with Kinnaird, but I didn't know him at the time, and so I chose to work with Charles E. Chapman, who was a Latin Americanist I hadn't particularly known up to that time, but whom I came to appreciate. Chapman had had a very odd career in that he'd started off as a professional baseball player, although not under that name, and had then taken a law degree at Harvard, and had decided not to practice law, so had been wandering around. He had gone to Japan, in fact, on a trip that his father had given him after he graduated from Harvard Law School, and had played some baseball there, and had almost, in a sense, introduced baseball there. This was back in about 1907 or 1908, and had managed to, without any warm-ups, play a game of baseball and ruin his arm, so he never could play baseball again.
Mm-hmm.
He decided then, when he came back to the San Francisco area, to study history, and persuaded Morse Stevens, who was the little crotchety Englishman who was the chairman of the history department there at Berkeley, to let him start in studying, although to get a master's he had to duplicate, Stevens said, all of the undergraduate work that he hadn't taken. So he plugged through that and distinguished himself enough in his graduate work that he was given the first very cushy fellowship that Berkeley had, which was the Sons of the Golden West, or Native Sons of the Golden West, or something. There are a lot of bawdy verses about that. And it makes, in any case, there is an organization that had sponsored, had funded a nice fellowship, traveling fellowship, and Chapman was the first recipient. Went to Spain, stayed 2 years, worked in the archives, and dug out all of the California material in the archives, and published this, then a guide, which has been the standard calendar of guide used ever since for the Spanish archives for California and Western materials. He then had been very active in writing, but by the 1930s he had for a time sort of lost interest. I don't know why. He continued to teach, but took no graduate students, and when I became a graduate student of his, he was just, in a sense, sort of re-emerging to scholarship after a period of quiescence, and there were three or four of us that he took on at that point. He organized a seminar, which was a tremendously good one, It involved, and at Berkeley, the seminars were, if you signed up for with your major prop for a seminar, you took a seminar with him forever after. And these were continuous, and every term. And you produced a paper every term, a two-parted paper, one that was bibliography, another part was content. And in addition to producing these two papers, you were a critic on two other papers, one for content and one for bibliography. And since these papers were turned in 2 weeks in advance, you had a chance as the critic and the duty to virtually reproduce the work done by the writer. And then to very painstakingly point out whatever errors he'd made. And these were frantic affairs. Chapman himself did the same thing. So that the seminar, at the time of the seminar, you gave up the person who was the pièce de résistance that day, the victim, didn't read his paper. He gave a lecture for an hour or something approximating that. And then the critics, including then Chapman himself, read their reports. And these were the most frantically critical things that you can imagine. This was both a very good and a very bad experience. It, in a sense, ruined reading forever afterwards for you, because you could immediately spot so many errors of style, or were slowed down so much by the process that it, for some years, in fact, reading, you were inhibited in the process of reading by this inquiry, this method that you were forced into adopting. Well, while I was there at Berkeley, I finished up my, I got my prelims out of the way in the fall of 1940. I took my, I had fellowships in the meantime, teaching fellowships, as well as this private fellowship I had. So financially, I was fairly well off. In fact, got married in February of 1940 and fathered a child, born then in April of 41. I finished my prelims in the fall of 40. I got my oral out of the way in the spring of 41, just before my first child was born, about 5 days before. And then I was granted a traveling fellowship to go to Mexico in the summer of 41 to work on my dissertation. And I left for Mexico in August of 41 and didn't return to the States then until approximately July of 42. I had permission from my draft board to go, but still was sort of bowled over when the war came in December 41. But on the advice of the military attaché in the Mexican embassy, or in our embassy in Mexico City, I stayed where I was and had no further problems. I returned to the States in the spring of 42, or in the early summer, and came back by way of Washington, where I was interviewed by some people in the State Department. Washington was obviously in the midst of a war crisis and very busy at that point, but I'd been asked to come back that way. It was good that I did, because when I'd gone through customs coming in to the States, all my film that I had taken in the archives in the past year were seized by censorship, and while I told them that there was nothing there of any military nature, unless it was in the 16th century, they told me that they would have to take the films, and there were about 1,000 feet of them, about 8,000 frames, in other words, and that they would then have to contact prints of them, which would make very small prints, and that would cost me 5 or 7 cents, I forget which, Well, I told them I didn't have that much money and that that wouldn't do them any good because they couldn't read the 16th century script that a lot of them were in. Not unless they took the paleographical courses that I'd had to take. In any case, I told them just to hold them there and I'd let them know what to do. And when I was in Washington, I ran into a friend of mine who was in censorship. The Office of Censorship had been organized after the war started. I ran into this man in Latin American history whom I'd known, and it turned out that he was in censorship, and so he took me to the boss man, and we rescued my films. We got them sent out to my father-in-law's home in the San Fernando Valley, California, and there they stayed in his garage for the next 3 years, or 4 years, I forget. 4 years. 4 years. Well, after the interviews in Washington, which were apparently good enough so that I got a job offer later on, but not right then, I went on back to California where my wife had gone, and deciding that it wouldn't do to go back to school at that point, since I figured that I would be drafted sooner or later, I took a job momentarily in the Kaiser shipyards as an expediter, which means you run around and find things for people if you know where they are. Well, I worked there for only 3 weeks when I was offered a job teaching through a person I'd known, teaching at a girls' school in Columbia, Missouri, Stevens College. And they were nice enough to have me interviewed there in Berkeley by someone that an administrator at Stevens knew. And when he asked me how much I wanted to work for, I told him what I was getting in the shipyards, and I got that, which was an unheard-of large salary for the day, as far as I was concerned. Well, I accepted the job, went on back to Missouri, picking up my wife and child, and stayed there then for just over a year, and went into the Navy from Columbia, Missouri, having been commissioned a lieutenant junior grade at that point. And so that I spent then from mid-September, I guess it was, or early October, one or the other, 43 until about the 1st of November, 46, in the Navy. First going for some indoctrination training, then getting a gunnery officer job in the Caribbean and Atlantic, and then ultimately the same type of job in the Pacific. We ran into no real military problems in the Atlantic. We had more problems with hurricanes than anything else. And then in the Pacific, I was either always the day came in toward a day after the attack or left the day before the attack, so that actually my military record was zilch as far as shooting people were concerned. They were always threatening air attacks when I was there, but they never came off somehow. But in any case, I came back to the United States in the summer of 45, with the expectation then that we would refit the ship I was on and go back then for the grand invasion of Japan, which was slated then for later in that year. Luckily, the war ended while I was still in port, so that the grand invasion didn't occur. I stayed on then in the Navy for almost another year, staying in the San Francisco Bay Area, and doing sort of odd jobs for the Navy. I started back to school then in the fall of 46, preparing to, at that point, to pick up my research and finish the degree. And I started on that. It was a question of diving back in again after being out so long. So that I did little more than just reacquaint myself with some of the material. And I was still in the process of doing that when I was offered a job at the University of Michigan, a temporary lectureship, to take Arthur Ayton's place while he was away on some trip for the State Department. That was a job then that was to last for the spring and summer of 47, with some possibility of going beyond, although this was rather remote. So I came to Michigan in February 47 and stayed there then through into September of that year. And by April or May, I'd been offered a job at Wayne and had accepted it for the fall. So moved on over to Detroit in September of 47.
Mm-hmm.
As an assistant professor of history, but without a degree yet.
Dr. Geis, could you tell me a little about the situation at Wayne State in the immediate post-war years of 1947?
Well, it had grown frantically. It had, by the time I arrived, 10,000 students, and only one classroom building, Old Main, which had not yet been called Old Main. Hillbury gave it that adjective. It was just Main. It was called. They also had bought, just before I arrived, the old Webster Hall Hotel, which they were turning into a combination. Well, it was mostly a student center and dormitory at that point. And they would later, under the name of Mackenzie Hall, turn it into a wholly an administrative center. But that took a number of years. They had put up some temporary structures around, old army barracks type or something, but mostly the classes were being held in old homes along Warren and Putnam and Merrick and Kirby and 2nd and Cass. Those were really fairly well the boundaries of the university at that point. Stretching up as far north as Kirby, as far south as Hancock, and from Cass over to just beyond, over to about 3rd, I guess it had gotten, or no, it hadn't gone to 3rd then. It was only at about to 2nd. It was moving into the 3rd area, I guess. They had received a grant and were in process of building the first section of what came to be known as State Hall. That's the not the front segment along Cass, it's the section that goes between Cass and 2nd. That section went up in my first year here and was not occupied until I'd been here for about a year. The other segment came somewhat later. Science building came rather soon after that. These were the only buildings they had for a long time, in addition to Old Main, and then these various temporaries and old houses. They had lots of students. They had 10,000 students, almost all undergraduates. The law school was small and not very good, from all reports. The other schools were, except for education, were small. The very medical school was a small medical school then, although it was quite solid.
Mm-hmm. Many of these students were veterans taking advantage of the GI Bill of Rights, is that not true?
Great hosts of them were. And these tended to be older than the usual college age, and many, not all, were very interested in learning, not particularly, they were in a hurry, that's true, but they were not particularly vocation-oriented in the present sense, that they didn't demand that things necessarily and immediately pertain to what they wanted to do ultimately. They were generally very intellectually open and eager. Mm-hmm. They were nice kids to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
They could offer, because of they were a little older and had seen a little of the world, although not necessarily the best parts of it, they could offer a little of this intellectual combat that I think is characteristic usually of a graduate school rather than an undergraduate school.
Mm-hmm.
So it was fun to teach them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think at that point the university's teaching, the attitude of the teachers was one that was very, very good, and it was certainly far more student-oriented than research-oriented. In fact, there were very few research-oriented persons around at that point.
Mm-hmm. Are there any other things that you think should be mentioned about the immediate post-war years at Wayne besides the life?
Well, I didn't. In a sense, the post-war years had already begun when I arrived.
Mm-hmm.
There was a new dean who had come, who had been in the Army, Vic Report, had come in late 45, I think. He had been one of the early outs. As soon as the European theater closed down, he was here.
Mm-hmm.
And he was in the process. He was very growth-minded. And he was going to, he would, from 45, late 45, until he was kicked upstairs in 61, Vic would really see to the growth and the continued validity of the College of Liberal Arts.
Mm-hmm. A lot of this growth that you mentioned was encouraged publicly by President Henry right after World War II. And eventually, the desire for new funds, the desire for new facilities, led to Wayne University becoming Wayne State University in 1956.
That happened after Henry had left at
uh-huh.
the last stage, and I don't know that he had anything to do with it. Henry was a dreadfully cold fish, is my own feeling about him. He could also, to mix the metaphors, be called a chameleon, and that he changed his colors to suit whatever exigency was at hand. He was a flaming New Dealer at times, and then became a very crusty conservative. Depends on where he was and what the circumstances were. He was the original changeable Charlie.
Mm-hmm.
But curiously enough, Henry contributed a great deal to the university in that he was very well liked by local businessmen, business leaders, and he in fact made the university known to these. Long before the university was widely known in the community, it was widely known to the community leaders by virtue of that man. He was very good at that. He made a very good public impression until he shook hands with you and you thought you had some sort of a dead fish in your hand. But no, Henry did a lot for the university.
Mm-hmm.
And he carried it probably as far as he could carry it before he went on then elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
He could be slimy as could be at times. He did have a hatchet man at his side, a man who was later on the provost or something out at the University of Oregon system, Jack Richards.
Mm-hmm.
And but at the same time, he attracted a public attention, and this was for the good of the university, because this, remember, was a streetcar college, and most of the people in the city didn't know the school,
mm-hmm.
Since it, in their mind, was just a sort of a added-on feature of the high schools. They didn't know.
Mm-hmm.
Those that did know the university knew that it was very high quality. with a sizable number of its graduates going on for very distinguished work
mm-hmm.
in all sorts of fields. The emphasis here up to that point and even a little after that was on teaching undergraduates. And while there were not very many lecturers that were known for their histrionics or any of that sort, there were lecturers that could attract the bright students' interest and get them to go on for work. In fact, there still are some people on the faculty here at Wayne who started as undergraduates at Wayne, were so impressed with the scholarship and depth of learning of their profs that they went on into scholarship themselves. Some are at the point of retirement now, some have retired, but for years there were such men as Sidney Glaser in history, now mm-hmm. retired, a graduate of Wayne, who then went on to do doctoral work at Michigan. Link, Orville Link in English, Max Carl in mathematics, and then later on the principal founder of Monteith College and its associate dean, Henry Burgess in Spanish. They're just shoals of these people, mm-hmm. these people who were around at one time or another,
mm-hmm.
who had done their undergraduate work here and who came back because of their interest in the place. And
mm-hmm.
these people were dedicated teachers. They had mm-hmm. had that experience in here. They were very excited by the people that they had met, such as Hoekstra in philosophy or Bossenbrook in history. And in fact, in history, that we've had a number of distinguished graduates who've gone on. At the moment, one of the men who's really top in his field, who's off into the field of philosophy and history, is Hayden White, who took both an undergraduate and a master's degree here to study with Bossenbrook, and then went to, I don't remember where, Rochester or someplace else for his doctorate. Hayden was an outstanding student and has remained so.
Mm-hmm.
And there are quite a number of these people. Bob Quirk at Indiana is another one, in Latin America in his case. There are others. So that in fact, you look around, there are a whole host of distinguished graduates of the university, particularly from this earlier period when we didn't mostly the departments were not interested in or didn't have time to do research, but were plowing much of their research effort into students.
Mm-hmm.
This changes later on, and I think we lost something in the process, but it's a process that every school seems to go through with as it goes more and more toward the graduate and research side and spends less and less effort
mm-hmm.
on the undergraduate side. This change came to be very marked with us in the latter 50s, early 60s. And
mm-hmm.
we still, I don't know, but what we're getting back to the earlier period by economic stringency, I don't know.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in the amount of faculty input into the decision to become state supported in 1956. I know Governor Williams appointed Alexander Ruflin, who was then president of the University of Michigan,
right,
to head a commission, I think, of 38 members to study the entire Wayne University picture as to whether or not state support was valid at that time. And I know the Ruflin Commission did a voluminous amount of work on this proposal and finally did come out within several months with its findings that yes, indeed, Wayne State should be state-supported. Did the Ruflin Commission notify the Wayne University faculty directly as to their, if it's for any input into this decision? Do you remember?
My memory is that it didn't. In fact, my memory is that there was very little faculty input
mm-hmm.
in the process. We knew this was going on, and we had all sorts of jokes about creating a sort of unified system. In fact, we were going to have one name and make it the acronym for Detroit was MUD, Michigan University Detroit. The acronym for Lansing was MUL, Michigan University Lansing East. And I forget what the acronym was for Ann Arbor, MUAA, I guess, or something, but I forget now.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But no, the faculty wasn't asked a great deal about it. There is a paper written on this process that was pretty much an indictment of the Hilberry administration. In fact, I don't know that you've ever seen this paper. It was published by a political scientist by the name of Halpern, H-A-L-P-E-R-N, Sam Halpern, who is now very high up in Democratic politics as a legislative liaison or something for HEW in Congress. Maybe he's been fired from this job along with whoever that lawyer was that Carter fired.
Mm-hmm.
But Sam published a paper on this which was very unflattering to the actions of the Hilberry administration. And in part, if I remember correctly, it was an indictment of his lack of faculty input.
Mm-hmm.
Hilberry, I don't think that he would do this by intention, but he's sort of governed by cronyism. He had been so long on the faculty in the English department and then as the dean of administration. He had a whole series of very close friends in the faculty that he tended to think of as these were the people that he consulted, and he really didn't consult others.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So my feeling is.
Mm-hmm. So you don't remember any special committee work by faculty or et cetera?
No, I don't. Mm-hmm. I could be wrong on that because at that point I was really trying to get into research and I was really spending my time on my family and my research rather than faculty affairs.
Mm-hmm.
I was involved in departmental affairs. But not, I think I was just beginning to get involved outside of the department by that point.
Uh-huh.
I had been involved by that point in a series of committees that were significant, but they had special tasks that, you know, didn't tend to be involved with these other things.
Mm-hmm. Is it true that state control meant that Wayne State could enlarge its research facilities, its grants for research? Would you consider that a true statement? Or do you think this would have been inevitable?
I think it would have been inevitable.
Mm-hmm.
There was a period of 3 years in which the university got both state and local financing with the deliberate intention of the city giving a sort of an endowment, building up a sort of an endowment fund for the university so that the school Board of Education kept up its support of the university at the same time that the state phased in its support. And they got enough money to build some new buildings and to in a sense, begin the funding of research.
Mm-hmm.
No, the thing that changed, it wasn't the state support necessarily. The thing that changed the character of the university and emphasized the research was the opening of the various PhD programs.
Mm-hmm.
This had begun as early as about 45 with chemistry, but didn't go to other departments significantly for some time after that.
Mm-hmm.
The history department was the sixth or seventh of such departments to get PhD programs, and that didn't occur until the mid-50s anyway,
mm-hmm.
or the latter 50s perhaps.
member of the history faculty at Wayne State. You've done a considerable service on many committees. One, the University Council, another, the Graduate Committee, and others. Do you think that your service on these committees and the committees themselves have played an effective role in determining and shaping Wayne State policy toward curriculum, budgetary matters, physical facilities, or other matters? Do you think that they have exerted some sort of influence within the university community?
Yes, I think so. Although for, as a joke, I used to say for about 15 years that I was paid my salary to sign my name and attend meetings. While that was a joke, I was serious in that, to the degree that I thought my work on committees and councils was of some significance, and that my membership there and the membership of other faculty members was very significant in determining university policy. It's hard to point out anything except incidents in this process, but I think at the Faculty Council of the Liberal Arts College, it's immediately visible, the influence of the Faculty Council, and that the dean has consistently over the years, since Vic Report was dean, beginning back in 45 or so, has consistently demanded that his council, the elected members of his faculty serving as a council, determine the policy of the college. And this, I think, has been done by this council. This is true also to a large degree of the Graduate Council, although there you have for a long time, with the because of the inter-college rivalries and the insistence of minor colleges, as far as numbers are concerned, at least minor, attempted to play major roles in determining graduate policy. This meant then that to keep from having too large numbers, you had to cut down on the numbers for the major producers of graduate degrees, the Liberal Arts College and the Education School, to allow then at least nominal membership to social work, to nursing, to law, and to other schools that did not really take leading parts in producing numbers of graduate students or graduate degrees, but wanted to hold up their own the prestige of their colleges, et cetera, in participating in the decision-making process. This meant at times that these schools perhaps played too large a share, and in attempting to fight for their own rights, they limited then the ability of the graduate division to act. But again, here it's the I think the faculty that's determining policy. At the University Council, that's a very large body of upward of 70 to 80 members now. And here it's harder for individual members to play a leading part, but they still manage to make their voices heard, and they still manage, particularly in the various standing committees of the college, of the council, to do very effective work in determining admission policies and determining matters of instruction and curriculum and such. I belonged at first to the budget committee because I thought that's what I asked to be assigned to, because I thought when I joined the university council that would be a more important committee. No, the research committee is what I asked for. But that turned out to be, at least at that point, a committee that had very little to do or very little power. And I then switched over to the CNI committee, the Committee of Curriculum and Instruction, and stayed on that committee for the rest of my tenure on the University Council. And in fact, then was on the committee even after I had gone off the council, because the university council asked that a member of the graduate council be assigned as an observer and participant to that committee. So I was on, in effect, the CNI committee long after that I had gone off the university council. These bodies do perform valuable functions and do determine policy, because it's been consistent through the Hilberry and the later administrations, the Hilberry, Keast, and Dullin, and then I suppose, although I can't certify because I haven't been there most of the time, the Bonner administrations. These councils have played a fundamental part in determining academic policy. And in the Gullin administration, in fact, the university council got access to the boards of governors and could meet, they had their own members in the university budget committee and other such committees to sit with the administration and to determine and to make sure that the administration was following the guidelines set in the university council and such bodies. No, I think they're very significant.
Excuse me. As a member of the curriculum committee of the council, what criteria are used in the selection of new curricula?
Well, there's always the problem of duplication. If there seems to be a duplicate of a program elsewhere, we would always disapprove. We would refuse to go along with it. We oppose duplication in the colleges. We oppose duplication within the colleges, as well as then duplication in other colleges. As the graduate officer of the college, I was also the chief curriculum officer, the designated by the college council and by the dean to act in this. And I passed on all course proposals, and if there seemed to be duplication, I, in fact, was empowered by the dean to call department chairman together and, in effect, to knock heads and to decide who would have such a program and whether it should be cross-listed or should be approved at all, because we were opposed to duplication. There has to be some duplication. The people in statistics, in mathematics, don't teach it in the way that the people in psychology and in other such areas where they are users of statistics want it taught. So there have to be some duplications. But we always tried to keep these minimal. And the CNI committee was interested in trying to keep down duplication. We also were vitally interested in the quality of the program. Mm-hmm. Who were to be the students? What sorts of students were to be admitted? Who were to be the teachers? All of these things came into it. Mm-hmm. No, it was quality. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I think no matter who was on the committee, the people that were there were interested in these and remain interested. Mm-hmm. These are very tough committees to get by. Mm-hmm.
Were you a member of the curriculum committee during the late 60s?
Yes.
Were there any unusual pressures upon the university to change curricula for minority groups?
Oh, very strong pressures. Very strong pressures to create black studies programs of one variety or another, to get rid of language studies, to do any number of things. I also, during part of that time, was a member of and later chairman of a presidential commission on student records, which was a real pain in whatever part of the anatomy you want to pick up, in that we met once a week for, I don't think we missed a meeting for 18 months, year-round, and looked at student records and to decide what we should keep, what we shouldn't keep. We were under great pressure from student activists to get rid of all sorts of things and to deny access to records to all sorts of people, employers, parents, you name it. Mm-hmm. The university was under all sorts of pressures. It
I think generally we were eager to create programs of this sort if they could, if it could be shown, or if we could provide quality programs.
Mm-hmm.
In history, for example, we were always under very heavy pressure to offer courses in Negro or Black history. And we resisted that pressure to the degree that we argued that you really couldn't unless you could get very qualified people, and they hadn't, most of them hadn't been trained at that point, you were just going in for what these people dislike most, segregation. That our goal in history was in fact to try to get some sort of amalgam, universal, and that while these people should get proper coverage, Black history in itself meant nothing unless you had it in the context of the, in which these Blacks lived.
Mm-hmm.
And that had to be, in effect, American history. Furthermore, if you had Black history, why not Jewish history, Italian-American history, whatever variety you can think of, and you reach the end of absolute stupidity.
Mm-hmm.
We did, ultimately, in the history department, add first, an Africanist, which we'd been searching for a long time. We got a qualified one. We then added a specialist in Black American history, but it took a long, long time. We searched for a long time before we got the individuals that we thought qualified.
Mm-hmm.
As far as a Black studies curriculum was concerned, the college resisted the idea of such a curriculum, although it went along partially toward that. But again, the emphasis is on getting people who are qualified.
Mm-hmm.
In general, we would not, we were declared to be old fogies in most respects, and retrograde something or another. But in general, we were insistent upon quality,
mm-hmm.
high quality.
Mm-hmm. Has there been pressure from community groups?
Heavy pressure.
I was thinking in particular possibly a history of Ford Motor Company or the automobile industry,
no,
per se.
No, very little of that sort. Very little of that sort. Alan Nevins took off some of that pressure from all the people in creating his first his oral history project at Columbia, and then his work on the Ford Motor Company. I think this relieved many departments of history of pressure of that sort as a result. I don't think that the manufacturers, the industrialists, were really interested in trying to get history written to suit them. I don't know how many of them were, the leaders were even aware of history to begin with as a discipline. And I think, too, that they were much too aware of public opinion to try to dictate any official histories or anything of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that you have I don't know of many instances where there have been official histories of that sort that were written and that were granted much in the way of any credence. They are largely went by the board. As far as the Wayne history faculty was concerned, there were two projects in which sort of official histories were paid for by companies. One of them was published. This was the work done by Raymond Miller on the Detroit Edison Company. Edison dictated policy at all there. It gave a grant, and Miller could do what he pleased about writing it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe there was even a final word on what would appear.
Mm-hmm.
The other grant of this sort was from the Michigan Consolidated Gas Company, and a history of it was written by an economic historian in the department by the name of Martin Wolf, now at the University of Pennsylvania. And Marty's book was never published. The college got the grant, got the money, Marty's salary was paid, but the company ultimately decided not to publish, and it was never published,
mm-hmm.
and never will be published.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it was because I think the board just lost interest in it and said that was, you know, that was money that it had spent, to hell with it.
Mm-hmm. How about the opposite point of view? Unions, again, particular, since we're in Detroit, the United Auto Workers, has there been any kind of special relationship between, for instance, the UAW and the labor studies program at Wayne State? Obviously, Wayne State has a very strong labor studies program. We have the Ruther Archives.
Well, the university was very chary and wary of this. There was a labor institute, which was jointly the University of Wayne and Michigan. And this one got involved in union politics first, and then in management politics. And it lost credence. And the university was very happy to sort of shuck it off. And Michigan also was just happy to get rid of it. So that the labor studies just more or less lapsed, or interest in labor studies, except in the economics department and certain other departments, individual scholars kept up an interest. But for a long time, the university was very, very aloof from any notion of this. There were individuals who worked for this, but that Ruther Archive came as a sort of an outgrowth of Phil Mason's work as a university archivist, and he just sort of enlarged his field. And I suppose Ed Cushman encouraged Phil in doing this. The UAW got interested in a sense, getting rid of records. And Mark Kahn in economics, who was an arbitrator for the airline and for the air industry, got interested in bringing the records of the ALPA here, the Airlines Pilot Association. And the labor end of the archive just evolved, in part out of the personal interests of Mason, of Cushman, and of the desire on the part of certain of the labor unions to get their records housed someplace and to get rid of the responsibility of maintaining them themselves. So it's a happenstance more than anything planned.
Mm-hmm.
And the university was very aloof, I think is the real word to use, for a long time from any idea of any association with the unions.
Mm-hmm.
Detroit is a union town, but it's a union town that refuses to vote union, in that there were a series of races in the 1940s and 1950s and 1960s in which there was heavy labor. There were labor candidates, Frankenstein, George Edwards, not this one now, but the father, the circuit court judge, George Edwards. And a series of others were open labor candidates, and they got defeated, usually,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
because the city would vote against labor.
Mm-hmm. Do you know of any special attempt by the UAW to use possibly the university as a vehicle for dissemination of pro-UAW, pro-institutional labor?
I think in general the UAW has, Ruther was not interested in this. And I think the influence of the man who succeeded Ruther, who now is the U.S. ambassador to China,
Mr. Woodcock.
These people didn't want to be accused of influencing educational policy, and they stayed away from it.
Mm-hmm.
They leaned over backwards, I think, not to do
mm-hmm.
this. They had close relationship with various profs and certain administrative units, but they didn't want the university condemned as a UAW stooge.
Also on a more local note, during, I believe, the 1950s and then eventually during the 1960s, the faculty at Wayne State became unionized, and there was some sort of a rivalry between the Detroit Teachers Association and the Detroit Federation of Teachers, the latter being an affiliate of the AFL. And do you remember exactly the atmosphere during the time and the competition, which I've read is was somewhat severe between the two to organize the Wayne faculty? Do you remember this particular period?
Yeah, fairly well. There was a there was a small American Federation of Labor group all along in the university. If I remember correctly, I could identify some people, but they are all, I believe, gone from the university now. But there'd been a small chapter there, or group, that had been largely active in social causes of one sort or another. But there was no real move to unionize the faculty. I think the there was a state law that was passed, must have been about 1960 or thereabouts, which made it possible, I think, to unionize the faculties for the first time. And the AFT and the MEA all began to take interest in the university, but weren't getting very far until, in a sense, the administration itself sort of encouraged this. At least this is the belief on the part of a good part of the faculty. Gullen was had been a labor negotiator for the American Motors Company. Cushman also had been this. And they seemed to think in terms of solving some of the problems with the faculty by getting a unionized faculty and be only one group to deal with. There had been a lot of faculty dissension, in part, just a lot of faculty dissension. And in a sense, the Gullen people seemed to feel that they could get rid of certain of their problems if they got a union. So they were certainly benign in their attitude. Perhaps they didn't openly abet and encourage, but they certainly didn't block any move to hold an election and to get a union. And the MESC was called, Employment Securities
Commission
was called in. A certain number of signatures were gotten to call for an election, and an election was held. And in part, almost with union, with administrative connivance, the decision was made that the unit would consist of faculty and certain staff members, particularly the library staff and the advising staff, would be joined with the faculty. This was opposed by probably the majority of the faculty, but they had no real chance to get their opinion to be effective in their opposition.
Mm-hmm.
They had no real chance because the other decision was that in the election to be held, the units that wanted to be bargaining agents, the MEA, the AF of L, not the AFT, and the other, the AAUP, which decided at this point to enter the fight. These units already existed on the campus, and they offered themselves now as bargaining agents. The other chance that you had was to say no, but the no people couldn't organize, couldn't get much in the way of any expression, and they had really no chance. In a sense, the thing was foregone. It was to be unionized.
Mm-hmm.
There was no real chance for a yes and no vote. This was not allowed.
Mm-hmm. How was the ballot constructed?
The ballot was constructed. You voted for MEA, the AFT, the AAUP, or no.
Mm-hmm.
Probably the majority of the faculty did not want unionization. Certainly some faculties were solidly opposed to it. Some departments were solidly opposed to it. The librarians were mad as hell about everything you could think of and wanted the union. And saw a chance to get a better situation for themselves. The advising staff also were solidly pro-union and wanted a chance to use this as a vehicle
mm-hmm.
for getting more pay, better recognition, everything else of that.
Mm-hmm.
So these were the people that voted strongly for unionization, and these are the people who represent the largest number of members in the union today.
Mm-hmm.
They had to join the AAUP. Most of them hadn't belonged to the AAUP. They belonged to these other organizations. But when the AAUP won the election, then these people joined in
mm-hmm.
and came to dominate. Because large numbers of us that had belonged to the AAUP dropped our memberships
mm-hmm.
Because we hadn't belonged to the AAUP when it was a union. It wasn't a union, it was
mm-hmm.
something else.
Mm-hmm. Is membership then voluntary today? To become a member of the AAUP, it's voluntary.
Yes,
today.
It's
uh-huh.
voluntary. They have tried to get an agency shop. They have not yet obtained it.
Mm-hmm.
It's voluntary, and it is still probably, they still have a minority of professors.
Mm-hmm.
They have a majority of librarians and advising staff, and then in some colleges they have sizable numbers of profs, and other colleges they have very few. There are very few people in the medical
mm-hmm.
college that belong to the union.
Mm-hmm.
There are very few in the engineering college. There are almost none in the business school. There are large numbers in education and social work, in nursing. It varies from department to department in the College of Liberal Arts. In chemistry, there's hardly a member. In physics, there are a number of members. It varies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What do you think have been the advantages and or disadvantages of unionization of the faculty?
Advantages, they've raised salaries. There's no doubt about that. Disadvantages, well, they've increased this tendency or strengthened this tendency which was already visible. The university, the colleges, the whole higher education system used to operate on the basis of trust and mutual trust. This was true of students with faculty, faculty with administration, faculty with faculty. It's disappeared.
Mm-hmm.
Much of it. The union makes everything adversarial.
Mm-hmm.
This is a preordained set of circumstances. The
mm-hmm.
union must act in an adversarial manner, and the administration then maybe would do it anyway, but it certainly is set up this way.
Mm-hmm.
Everything too is now has to be written down.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think
do you think the disadvantage or advantages have outweighed?
I think the disadvantages have been far greater than the advantages, but
mm-hmm.
The pay has been good, isn't
mm-hmm. it? Mm-hmm. Are you now a member of the AAUP, Dr. Geis?
No, I'm not. I had belonged for years before that, before the contract. And initially, with the first contract, I couldn't belong to the bargaining group. I was considered to be an administrator. Then the new interpretation came in that since I was only half-time administration, I could be belonged. So I, at the time of the first vote on the first contract, I rejoined the union in order to vote because my feeling was that the crazies, and I classified the librarians and the radical French. They were all on the radical French, not politically, but in mm-hmm. their demands for things. I figured that these people were, from all I could hear, were going to vote against the Union and were going to want it. They wanted a strike. They were very bitter. But I thought the first contract, as I could see it, was seemed to be responsible, seemed to be as good as the administration could give. I was in two camps, and saw, I suppose, more of the administration side than these other people. So I rejoined the Union and voted to, mm-hmm. for the contract. And then I dropped my membership after a time. I saw no reason to continue.
Mm-hmm. You've mentioned your dual role as a member of the as being associated with Wayne State University. You've been assistant dean of the Liberal Arts College and also a history professor, and at times both of those at the same time. Is that correct?
That's right.
Uh-huh. This has given you a unique perspective on the university from two different points of view. Could you comment on that?
Well, I'm sure there are people in the faculty that would not say that I had two different points of view, because I was probably, they would think, more pro-administration than pro-faculty. I don't really think that's true. I did have, I suppose, a certain degree of ambivalence. I suppose because I still maintained something of a feeling that if a person has risen to this high office, you can have a certain degree of, you must grant a certain degree of trust to what he says or what she says. And I tend not to challenge automatically the administration just because it's the administration. I can see some real faults with the administration. I can see some real faults with the faculty side too. So mm-hmm. as I remain somewhat ambivalent.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I have some very good friends in administrative office. I have some very good friends who on the faculty side. I don't like this having to take one side or the other.
Mm-hmm.
The adversarial system is not one that I like.
Mm-hmm. Do you think if you had a chance to do it over again, you would have remained entirely a history professor, or remained entirely with being a dean? Do you think? Do you perhaps think that if you could have perhaps made an earlier choice as one or the other, you would have been more happy with that?
Well, I was happy enough as it was. I'm not unhappy with what happened. But I resisted going into administration for a long time. I suppose this was born in me as a minister's son. I resisted the limelight in public office or the front job. I was forced into administration when I was teaching in high school, just because, I don't know why, but I was very quickly forced into administrative work. I resisted any thought of administration after arriving at Wayne here for a long time, although there were opportunities offered me. And it wasn't until about 1960 that I was even willing to consider the notion that I would accept an administrative appointment. I took a temporary job working for Victor Report, who had been the dean of the College of Liberal Arts and then had become the dean of international programs. I took a temporary job working with Vic in 62, I believe. And at that point was nominated for a regular administrative job, and I would have taken it had I gotten it. But I did not get that job, and what I did, in effect, was to face up to the fact that I seemed to have some administrative talents and I'd better utilize them. So that when an administrative job was offered me in 64, I took it.
Mm-hmm.
I was not entirely happy with my career in history at that point. So that this, in a sense, allowed a way out of that thing. But there was also the very fact that I had been fighting a battle for years within myself as to whether I should take an administrative job.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is with administration is I never wanted to be the front man. I don't like to make speeches. I don't like to have to strike attitudes. I like to work from behind the scenes where possible.
Mm-hmm.
At one point, I was being considered for the deanship, the graduate deanship. I don't think I would have been very successful in that. But in a secondary or down the line capacity, yes, I could
mm-hmm.
be very happy.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't have been happy in a full deanship,
mm-hmm.
making all these silly speeches.
Mm-hmm.
Not for me.
Uh-huh.
Presiding over all sorts of meetings. No.
Uh-huh. I wanted to ask you about life or campus life at Wayne State during the 1960s, during the latter 60s, a time of campus unrest over most of the nation.
Well, it didn't...
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
It didn't affect me too personally. We saw occasional bit of it in the classroom, although it was in the old classes in preliminary, introductory psychology and in sociology and that sort of place where you had more of the confrontations. But you felt a certain degree of this, and occasionally there would be some direct confrontations with students in my office over the question of graduate work. I was sued a few times, or threatened suit, but they never came off.
Who threatened suit?
Oh, there were a couple of three characters that did, because they were either denied admission to graduate work, or not necessarily by me, I was just part of the chain,
mm-hmm.
Or they were put on probation by me, or something else of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, there were some threat suits. They never actually came off.
Mm-hmm.
There were a couple of civil rights cases that did reach the that civil rights commission, but in each case I was upheld, so
mm-hmm.
I have no regrets in this.
Mm-hmm.
But mostly, as I said, I didn't feel the full direct brunt of this. I had no shouting matches in my classes or anything of that sort.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Dr. Geist, do you think that the student body at Wayne underwent a change of some sort during the 60s, or it was primarily a vocal minority, or do you think the majority of students were affected by what was going on with Vietnam, etc.?
It was a vocal minority.
Mm-hmm.
we had a chance, was it in 73, when they had the incidents done at Kent State and in Jackson State, wherever these were. And there was a moment when it looked like there would be a violent campus upheaval at Wayne, but Wayne, the average student at Wayne had no interest in upheaval, and the Wayne situation was much more comparable to the situation at Brooklyn College than it was to Columbia or Michigan or Michigan State or any number of Berkeley.
Mm-hmm.
The people you remember at Brooklyn College threw out the protesters, and they more or less did at Wayne too. They refused to go along with them. Now Keast, who was president at the time, thought we were in danger of a student strike, student violence, and wanted the university council to suspend classes, and we refused to suspend classes at that
mm-hmm.
point. Voted against his action. Despite the vehement protest on the part of a few of our own agitators. Basically, our faculty was more conservative, and I think our student body was more conservative.
Mm-hmm.
These were, in a sense, people who were on the make, who were upwardly mobile, and they didn't want the process interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't have much... remember, revolution seemed to come from the existing middle class rather than from below. And
mm-hmm.
ours were emergent middle class, and they didn't want the process interrupted.
Mm-hmm.
That's my feeling.
Uh-huh. Dr. Geist, you did retire this past summer, did you not, from Wayne State?
Right.
Uh-huh. After 33 years here as a history professor and assistant dean, how would you characterize your years here at Wayne State University? And would you have any recommendations, advice to current faculty, administrators, perhaps for the future?
Well, I think my years were generally very satisfactory. As far as advice, I don't think I have any advice. I think I'd like to touch on what has been the sort of changes here at Wayne, if they were significant in my changes in my view, at least. Seemed to me that, one, during my years here, Wayne joined the mainstream of American universities. And this has meant, one, that there's been a marked decrease in the interest in undergraduate teaching. When I first came here, it was the pride of the department that every department member, senior or not, taught undergraduate courses as well as his own graduate specialties. Mm-hmm. And they were intensely interested in undergraduate teaching. This ceased to be the case some years ago, but this is a characteristic of large American universities everywhere. It long ago was the case at California, at Wisconsin, at Michigan, at other such schools. The change came when they switched over largely the interest to research and graduate work. The other marked change that I think is part of the mainstream of American education today is the loss of loyalty to the institution. I was just at the sort of point of change when I came. The older people who had come here and those in the particular group that I came with came here, and the emphasis was on loyalty to the university, local pride, loyalty. And this meant that we were very quickly moved into putting massive amounts of our attention to faculty governance, to participation in departmental affairs, in college affairs, in university affairs. Our loyalties were to this particular university. And this was forced upon us, if you wish. Raymond Miller and others who were in the department insisted on this. This was one of the things that it was a characteristic attitude. This ceased to be the case, in part because as we entered the mainstream, we entered the national pattern of people coming and going. There was a loss of local loyalty. There was a loss of local loyalty in that we entered with a TIAA insurance system, annuity system, which is national. Then Social Security also is national. This meant that you could take your pension with you wherever you went. This hadn't been the case originally. You had your pension here, your first loyalty was here. You had to spend 15 years to get vested rights in your pension, and by that point you were situated and kept on automatically. You look to the younger faculty then have looked to the national situation. They come in with, where shall I move next? They already are thinking in terms, I'll be here so many years, I'll go on to another place, and they insist then on keeping their eyes fastened there, and this means virtually no participation in local affairs. This has worked a hardship on every university where this has occurred, but it's a national phenomenon rather than just Wayne. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what we do about it, except, of course, right now, with a lack of opportunity for going elsewhere, people are forced to go back a little more toward the other situation. Mm-hmm. Maybe the stringencies are not so bad after all. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Thank you very much, Dr. Geis.